My guest today is Claudia Adler, lecturer in International Humanitarian Affairs and Program Lead at University of York in London. With a passion for empowering marginalized women and girls globally, Claudia's research delves into innovative learning approaches across diverse cultural landscapes. Drawing from her experiences in grassroots initiatives in Uganda and Colombia, she brings invaluable insights into navigating complex humanitarian challenges. Born in Colombia, Claudia's journey from her homeland to her impactful role today has been nothing short of inspiring. And without further ado, let's just delve into understanding it firsthand from Claudia. Hi, Claudia. A very warm welcome to Atlanta Diaries. And thank you for putting yourself out there and sharing your amazing journey with my guests today.
Thank you so much, Enma, for having me. It's an absolute pleasure, and I really look forward to what will be our discussion and obviously sort of continuing listening to other guests that you have as well on this podcast.
Thank you. That means a lot. Let's get started. Born in Colombia during the 1980s, share with us, how did your formative years shape the trajectory of your life and influence the decisions you've made along the journey?
So I was born in Colombia in the 1980s, only child, very different to my mother, who was one of 11. She grew up in what is Manrique, which is quite a sort of poor area in Colombia. And you'll know that sort of Colombia has a very divisive class structure, sort of roughly 8 different classifications. And it's very difficult to be able to have that progression if you're coming from a very deprived family. Education and everything else can be sort of very different experience. So you have sort of those elites in Colombia, and then you have sort of more of communities which are sort of deprived and marginalized. And she came from that. Plus adding on that extra layer that you're in the 80s, and, you know, it's sort of the peak of the drug trafficking and the cartel of Medellin. And why that's relevant is because a lot of recruitment was done within those poor areas. They would recruit young men. They would recruit, you know, women as well. And so you have sort of that culture emerging of sort of fast money, a lot of violence as well. And her being one of 11 and having 5 brothers was sort of a very difficult time. And there's a lot of layers there. You know, you've got the violence, you've got the domestic violence that she grew up in, very violent household, and those frustrations that she saw sort of throughout her life. So I guess that was kind of my initial environment.
God, I'm getting goosebumps just listening to it. So what happened then, Claudia? Like, how did things change, and what sort of triggered that step from your mom's side?
I think it came from a heartbreak. My father had married her. They'd met in university. They'd had a whirlwind romance. And when she got pregnant with me, he met somebody else and left her, knowing that she would have to go back to a very precarious situation with her family. There wasn't sort of that compassion. There wasn't that care. And what's interesting to that is that I think sometimes some of our worst or most difficult situations in life brings us to the brink of this uncomfortability that makes us leave. So we can look at those experiences and we could see them with resentment, or we can see them as sort of those new beginnings, those very necessary beginnings. And that was one of hers. It took her to that brink where she said, I can't do this anymore. This isn't what I want for my daughter or for my family, and I need an out. And that was what made her get that out. A new life. She immigrated to the UK. She was 27. She'd never left the country before. She'd never been on an airplane before. She had very limited network in the UK. So it's really sort of commendable that a young 27-year-old, heartbroken, with not much of sort of cultural awareness in that sense, is able to find her feet in the UK and have that resistance and resilience and that determination to bring her family from what was a very difficult situation. And I think our story isn't any different to anyone else's. You have other stories which are sort of graver and sort of more heroic in that sense. But I think what makes it important is how you adapt your story to your life, how you use that to then construct your own thinking, and how you place yourself in sort of this world, be sort of your family or your work and so forth.
Does she talk about it today also, Claudia? It's very easy to say that you can change your perspective, but not everyone does that. You make it sound very simple. So do you think, was she like this, and that's why she was able to take that tough decision?
No, I think it was a process. I think we revisit our stories and our origins, and we see different sides and aspects to it, depending on where we are and what it is that we need. So I'm sure sort of along her life, she's gone back to it perhaps, and it's been painful, and she's gone back to it and she's seen herself as that hero, or she's gone back to it and she's seen herself as that vulnerable child. There's so many layers of it, and it depends where we are within. I think that's what I like about research and academia, and that a lot of things are fluid in that sense. And I think when we have that ability to be retrospective and to really sit with ourselves for a bit, we see that those lenses can change over time.
Yeah, I'm also wondering that she's one of 11, right? And you said five brothers. So it's only her who took that bold decision, right? What about her was different from all the other 11? And I'm sure your grandmom also played a huge role in making her what she did or what she became.
I mean, I think it was probably the two very different women, my grandmother and my mother. They're probably the antithesis of each other. My grandmother being very docile, having sort of endured 30 years of domestic violence, never leaving. My mother being very fiery, just a very different character. What made her do it rather than anybody else? I'm not sure. It could have been one, she's the eldest. I think two. One of the things that strike me about sort of her story is she promised them that she would never leave them. And that's a covenant that we make with people and sometimes with ourselves. And so I don't think it's necessarily characteristic, because some of them could have done the same thing, but I think it was a pact that she made. And that's what allowed her to sort of fulfill that promise.
I want to share this personal story. So my father is one of five siblings, and my grandmother used to always call him, in Hindi, there's a word called Kota Sikka, which is like, somebody who's not like the bright star in the family, but he was very hardworking and he was a completely devoted son. And he was an entrepreneur till he was 80 years old. And his dad invested in his business, and he promised his dad that whatever business I do, I'll make sure that the other siblings are a part of it. So when you share this, it really brought back some very special memories, and I really respect my father for it. And he's become a silent role model to us without even saying it to us in so many words.
Really beautiful.
Yeah. So Claudia, you were just 5.5 years old when you moved to UK, right? So do you remember any anecdotes or any experiences of that time?
I remember having a terrible earache, being on that aeroplane as a kid. I remember that. Feeling very sick. I threw up all over myself and my grandmother. I remember lots of turmoil. I think it was sort of slightly stormy. I arrived in Christmas, and coming from sunny Colombia, where I was used to sort of playing out on the street, you don't have sort of a schedule. You're in and out of neighbors' houses. It's a completely different world to then being in the UK, it being dark, particularly when I arrived, small apartment in North London, cozy in its own way, special in its own way, but it's complete, cultural displacement. And that's something that I talk about within my research. People can be displaced physically, geography wise, but then you also have a cultural displacement. Those attachments, those safety nets, those communities that you're used to relying on, that language and everything else, then gets completely taken away. And so you have to double adapt as well to sort of those cultural surroundings, which can sometimes be even more difficult to navigate.
So the PhD is at the heart of everything, right? So let's shift gears a little bit and talk to us about how did that journey start? What was the pivotal point? How come you moved from private sector to academia?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's quite interesting now if I look back and I see how those dots, join, because sometimes they won't make sense when you're sort of in the middle of it. And then you've got this really different skill set and you're like, actually, this was useful. I think from the beginning, I've always been more geared towards those social sciences, issues on equality, human rights. And I studied law, and that was really sort of refreshing. Because I think as a child that's immigrated or has that asylum seeker refugee background, education isn't something that's necessarily granted. You know, I come from a family where my grandmother learned to read and write peering through a primary school window because education wasn't for her. My mother attended a course at university where she met my father, but she also didn't have that opportunity to completely further develop her interests. She then did her university much later in life when she was sort of around 50 and she became a herbal practitioner. And I think children that come from sort of that refugee background, it's quite a disconnect with our education. And I think you don't have sort of those surroundings that allow you to really stimulate and really get to know yourself. And so the normal thing, you know, coming from state school in North London was you need to get a job. You're lucky if you get into university. You know, I think that's also the case for many people as well, where our education system isn't necessarily there to completely form us or to give us that sense of full fulfillment. And I think more so it's a system which fits the purpose for the marketplace. And that's where I found myself. I got into selling, I got into holding media events and portfolios. And yes, I enjoyed it and, you know, it paid the bills, but was it really kind of where my heart was? No. And so that's where I go back into education in sort of my 30s. I do my master's degree in humanitarian affairs. And then I have a really interesting and short conversation with one of my supervisors. I've got two incredible supervisors. One of them is Dr. Janica Jayawardena, Sri Lankan academic, and the other is Dr. Jo Rose. And on that graduation of my master's, she sat down and she said, "You know, Cloud, I think you should really consider a PhD. I think you'd be really good at that." And never had I ever thought that I could go and do that. And it wasn't imposter syndrome or anything like that. It was just that wasn't something written for me. You don't dare to dream. That's for somebody else to do.
So what kind of feeling then did you experience if it was an imposter syndrome?
It was more of an awakening in the sense of really, do you really think that I could do that? But it almost as somebody kind of like allowing you to see a different possibility that you hadn't.
Yeah.
So it was kind of an unveiling of another option or another door. Look at this door. Why don't you knock and see if, you know, if you're welcome in?
Almost like a permission to dream. Beautiful. Yeah. Now that you sort of gave yourself that permission, this can also be me. What's the first thing you did? And then, of course, how did you decide your topic? Because that again is very unique to bring your personal narratives and our thesis, and it's so powerful.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting what you've said. You know, I just want to pick up on that because I really liked what you said, which is giving myself permission. And I think it really starts with that. You know, we have to really sort of allow ourselves to give permission. And I felt the PhD is an academic endeavor, but more than that, it really developed my own thinking. It developed my critical thinking. It developed my personhood. And so I tried to look at it from that much more broader sense of learning. That's why in the title it says Beyond Schools and Jobs. How can education empower? Because sometimes the education that we receive in schools isn't the one that empowers us. So the thesis went out to really sort of have a look at what is the education that is empowering. And that took me back to my past and it took me back to the narratives of the women in my family and understand, you know, if these women are uneducated, if we take, say, my grandmother in that formal sense, you know, if we're comparing it from that, why then was she able to create the life that she has for herself? If she didn't receive formal education, then surely she should be disempowered and surely she should just be vulnerable. But we see something else come out and emerge from her story. And we see the same with those rural women, farmers as well, indigenous women. And we see that with sort of the narrative of my mother and myself to, you know, to a degree. So it was a very interesting sort of ethnography to be able to sort of delve, and it just felt really honored as well to be able to sort of revisit and retell those stories.
Wow, that's amazing. Talk to me more about it. Any anecdotes, any experiences from that journey of research?
Yeah, so at the beginning, it's a very personal journey. It's your own writing, and no one's reading this, only yourself and your supervisor are reading, and you don't know if it makes sense. You don't know what impact it's going to have, if it's going to have any at all. And I guess one of the most incredible things was to be able to interview a range of women from the Global South, women that have their own NGOs, women that have their own women's rights organizations, and be able to sort of delve into those stories as an equal, not as a researcher. So I think power is something that's always in sort of those relations. So I was very careful to be able to understand those power dynamics. And as I kind of, you know, introduced my own story and we spoke, it became more of a kind of participatory co-learning experience with these women. And what sort of comes out is a lot of their learning on what made them who they are was actually out of school. So schooling allowed them to develop skills and qualifications and sort of those certain kind of credentials that you need to be able to, say, apply for a job or, you know, work within that mainstream sector. But what really gave them sort of that gravitas was that wisdom that maybe they'd learned from their fathers, from their mothers, were those heartbreaking experiences. And what's quite interesting is nobody really gives you empowerment. Empowerment is an internal quality, okay? It's through life and those very difficult challenges that they then feel the strength to go beyond that unknown. You know, and you can see that in the crossing of my mum. You know, she left everything that she knew to a complete unknown. And it was in that process that she understood her strength. You end up knowing who you are. There was a lovely story with one of the ladies, and she came from a very affluent family, and they were escaping the war. They were in Egypt as refugees. Her mother had lost everything, her clothes, her jewelry, and the home that they were living in Egypt was infested with rats and mice. And she remembers telling her daughter, "We shouldn't be afraid of these mice. They're just families like ours. That's the mummy, that's the daddy, those are the children, just like us." And I thought that was kind of really beautiful, because there was this humility that she had learned by having so much to then teaching her child. Perhaps she would have never, ever seen something like that if she hadn't gone through that experience. And then it's just the way that we then change our perspective, and those narratives that we tell our children completely change. And I think that was quite incredible, because you could see a woman that she wasn't broken because of a situation, but she simply adapted.
Did you meet these people in person, or were these online researches?
It was online because of COVID, and that actually worked really well for me, because I managed to have a much more diverse group of women and different, you know, sessions. So COVID in that sense was a blessing in disguise.
Let's shift gears a little bit and help us understand your work today.
So currently I'm a lecturer. I teach international humanitarian affairs, so I look at everything that is conflict and that's disaster, and also incorporating into that now more than ever is sort of the climate crisis, which is sort of affecting so much of conflict. Specifically, sort of within my teaching and research, I look at communities, and there's a kind of political activism which I manage. So I think for me, it's very important to have that voice. And where I was saying to you, I think in one of sort of our previous discussions, is the relevance of who I am and my story is the fact that I'm able to at least put my thoughts out there. And that breaks away from sort of this hegemony and this sort of monopoly on thought. Not because of anything particular to me, but because I'm coming in from a completely different context. And so therefore I'm going to influence how I think and I see things. And that'll be very different to, say, somebody who maybe was born in the UK, is British, maybe came from sort of an affluent family, fell into academia quite naturally, and that was sort of their world. And it's a very different perspective. And that's the diversity within our thought and our experiences, the way that we see things and our approaches to being able to solve modern day challenges. And when I teach, I really try and motivate my students to develop that same critical thinking, for not accepting the status quo necessarily. And I look at that within humanitarianism. You know, why is it that we have a system that's largely directed by Western governments and Western NGOs to deal with issues from the Global South? Where are the voices of the Global South? And I think it's very important for there to be a shift. Why? Because we understand our needs. We understand our cultural needs. We understand how we need things to be built. It's not that West is good and global South. It's not that. It's just there needs to be a coming together. And those are those power dynamics that I've been talking about. And I think if we go back to education, the main issue in education is that it is set out for you. There's at no point where you are co-creating your education. Children aren't taught what they want to learn. They're not taught to decide what it is that makes them excited, but they're told what to learn. And so we have in these systems a monopoly. You know, you're taught what to learn. You're taught how humanitarian aid should be given. You're given a tent. You're given this, and those are your supplies. But there is no coming together with different thinking and thoughts. And I think now is a really important time to be able to shift that. So when we talk about decolonization, I think it's that it's sort of being able to actually understand that there needs to be a sense of ownership.
You sound so passionate when you share this. What led you to bring humanitarian front and center despite the supposed growth of the industry, if I had to call it that?
So I think that's why I sit on that peripheral, because I'm an academic rather than an actual aid worker or a, you know, humanitarian in that sense. So I'm able to understand the system, understand or look at certain issues which are happening within these communities, come in and co-create solutions with them, not come in and tell them what it is that they need, and then be able to sort of provide those reports to the powers above, the donors. And so some of my latest work with Dr. Joe Rose has been to formulate a framework that allows these huge organizations to then be able to understand what localization means, what it means to actually work with communities as equal partners. And I think there's a massive arrogance that because we're educated, we know more. And those are one of the issues that I have, and I really sort of push out within my work, which is, you know, why aren't sort of rural farmers, women that work within sort of water management, not sort of called scientists? Because they are scientists in their own right. But then if it doesn't fit within those very strict models, they're peasants or they're illiterate. And I think that needs to be broadened sort of. And those are the power dynamics, which, you know, I talk about. If I come into your family dynamic, which is your own community, or if it's a faith, I would know that there are certain rules and dynamics that you guys adhere to, right? All communities have their own protocols, their own moral codes, and so forth. And so from an outsider to come into that and then dictate to that community what should be done is a very arrogant position. And that's where I'm saying, it's not to say that the communities are great. No, we all have, you know, very difficult settings within sort of those communities, but there needs to be sort of coming in more humble, I think.
Absolutely. Any insight, you know, when you sort of went into those communities to really understand firsthand and then come back and share it with your students?
Yeah, so I guess it started with the research of all these old texts and religious texts and, you know, philosophies. Some of my favorite are, for example, that African philosophy of Ubuntu, which is I am because we are, and how that would change if we follow something like that, right? So I think so much of our current sort of schooling or educational worldview is made for you and I to see how different we are rather than to actually connect with those commonalities that you and I share. And that is exactly that philosophy, I am because you are, I am because we are. And so your humanity is sort of completely entangled in sort of each other. The other one, which I think is really lovely, is more of a one from South America, which is called Aini. And in Spanish, you know, it translates hoy por ti, mañana por mí. And that's something that I grew up with. And it's today for you, tomorrow for me. And they could seem very basic statements, but they're profound wisdoms, because from there, if you build a policy that understands that perhaps, you know, you're going to be in need and I'll be in need, and these power dynamics begin to sort of dissolve, and what you have is mutual aid coming forth, and we see each other more on equal kind of like platform rather than kind of one superior to the other. And Unfortunately, you know, that missionary approach to humanitarianism is charity. It is, I'm in a higher position and I bestow on you this. And so therefore be grateful because that is charity. Mutual aid is completely different, is we're in this together and it's just that today I'm going through this, but tomorrow I'll be there to help you.
Let's shift gears a little bit, Claudia, and let's talk about Claudia as a person, Claudia as a parent. The fact that you've navigated two fairly extreme cultures, you know, one which you grew up in and it continues to stay with you, and two where your growing years happened, which culture do you identify yourself with? Those are the different questions which come to my mind.
No, I love that. Motherhood is something that's incredibly important to me. Very lucky to have three boys. And I was always like, oh, I wish I had the little girl, but no. I'm actually spoiled by them and I wouldn't want it any other way. My parenting style, I guess, has that Latin influence because of my mother. And I think within sort of their upbringing, I understand that they have many mothers. I'm not the only one. My mum is a mum to them. My grandmother is a mum to them. My aunties are mums to them. And so the much bigger or broader sense to mothering my children. Something that I've kind of taken in is presence. I try and be very present with them. I try and actually kind of live those moments. And they are the most important people in my life. And I don't see them as mine, but I do see that I have a responsibility to help them develop themselves to their fullest. And that's, you know, how do I expose them and show them different parts of the world that will then either stimulate areas of interest, a little bit like kind of unveiling those doors. That's exactly how I see it. My role is to be able to unveil as many doors as I can for them.
You also spoke about, you know, your time in Africa with one of your sons.
So Dan and I, we're kind of opposites in that sense. He's grounded. He's very sensible. He doesn't really like crazy movements. And then he's got a mother who is slightly more adventurous, unpredictable, and, you know, a mess in that sense. And so I got this incredible idea to travel with him to Uganda when he was 10. And I got in touch with a contact of mine, very good friend of mine, Isaac Mohofa, and he offered us to live in one of the villages in one of the schools whilst I kind of like, you know, gave English lessons and just hang out with sort of the community. And Daniel got to experience rural life in Jinja. And that was a massive culture shock, but it was also an incredible experience. It's one that he will always remember and formed him in very different ways because you get to know yourself because you're kind of flung into scenarios that you're not prepared for. And then also a couple of years ago, Daniel again, he went to the Ivory Coast and he volunteered as an assistant to a vet clinic. And he got to do the most incredible things because obviously the setting is completely different. He got to wrestle with goats, kind of like give them vaccinations, tend to animals in ways that he wouldn't have been able to in any other place in the Western world. And so that was an incredible opportunity to really sort of like integrate there with those communities.
Looking back on your journey, Claudia, what advice would you give to your younger self?
That's a fascinating question. And I think an advice that I would give to Claudia would be to kind of like focus more on me. And that's not an egotistic way, but how could I have sort of tapped into my essence and understood some of that essence at an earlier age to then be able to sort of further develop that? Because I think sometimes we're taught to be very external based, look after people externally, and we forget ourselves. And I think understanding my essence, where I have now, has been pivotal. And I wish I could have kind of known that earlier on.
You know, this takes me back to when you talked about the master story, right? I think for the benefit of the audience, why don't you share that story with us before we end the session and a little bit about the human flourishing and creativity, which you know, said are very essential components of education. I see a lot of parallel in all these three topics.
Yeah, I think they really do overlap. So it's a really beautiful story. And, you know, I welcome everybody to go in and sort of read it. And, you know, it's told a lot better. But basically, it's a male deer and it's got tusks. And so it's rummaging through the forest because it's mating season, and smelling this most incredible sort of perfume of blossoms, and it's trekking, trying to find where the smell is coming from desperately, and it's pricking its nose in the different thorn bushes, and it's absolutely exhausted after trying to search and not being able to find. It pierces its pouch with its tusk as it falls from exhaustion, trying to find the origin of this smell. And as it falls and it pierces its pouch, it understands that the smell was coming from itself all along. And I guess that's that same idea, that when we talk about empowerment, it's not an external quality, it's internal. It just needs to be developed, in that we need to understand it and give it that space. And so when you talk about human flourishing, is we have an education system which is externally based. We do exams which are externally based, but there's very little pedagogy which then directs the learner to themselves. And that's where I'm saying you would engage with material or reading material so much better if you understood that essence, if you understood what it was that made you tick. You would naturally sort of explore that and probably devour books, right? Because it makes sense to you. And so that's that idea of human flourishing. Why is our education not providing healthier individuals? And I think we are in a global education crisis, whether we want to admit it or not. And I'm not the first to think about this, but I would like to see myself as a growing voice and a growing female voice in pushing for a pedagogy that looks at human flourishing. And particularly when we look at education in emergencies, and that's education in refugee camps, for example. One of the things that refugees in camps require and demand the most is education, sometimes even above food and shelter in that sense, because they know how important it is. And I feel that it's not the students, but it's our education system is really letting us down, because you have incredible potential. But why is it that some of the most intelligent people are waging wars in the way that we see right now? That's not an education system that's fostering, you know, health and peace. That's an education system that's fostering unhealthy competition, unhealthy division.
Thank you for this conversation, Claudia. I think it's going to give a lot of people a lot to think about, and really appreciate all that you shared.
Thank you so much, Enma, for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for being a part of this incredible journey with Atlanta Diaries. I have had the privilege of hosting guests who courageously shared their most vulnerable selves with me. And even if only a small segment of these conversations can champion the journey of one person, it will be worth each and every moment. And together, we know we can create an even greater impact. So I do have a humble request for you. If you found value in these episodes, please consider sharing the podcast with your friends, family, and on your social media. I would also love to hear your thoughts, and will really appreciate if you could take a moment to leave a review or rating. See you next week for another inspiring journey on Atlanta Diaries.